Case number 2-09-1045, Terry v. Astru. Good morning, Ms. Kobayashi.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, my name is Kristen Kobayashi and I represent Plaintiff Appellant Ms. Latricia Terry. The ALJ made numerous errors in his decision requiring reversal. The first being he failed to ask the vocational expert whether his testimony was consistent with the DOT. And this is required both under Social Security Ruling 004P and this Court's holding in Prochaska v. Barnhart.
I'm particularly interested in the unsigned report.
Okay.
And so I would like to ask you, if the agency supplements the record with a signed copy of the currently unsigned report, would you concede that the ALJ's finding that Terry can perform sedentary work is supported by substantial evidence?
No, I would not find that. And the ALJ did not solely find sedentary work in the residual functional capacity assessment. First, if the commissioner is correct in his assumption that the report is dated sometime around October of 2005, then that still leaves all of the 2006 evidence which was not considered by that doctor. And so I would argue that that should be given little weight. It's also not clear that the ALJ specifically relied on that report, although he does allude to at least agreeing with the sedentary limitation
of the report. That's, I guess, another way around. I was concerned about that report also, and it seems to me that if we were to conclude that the ALJ didn't really rely on it anyway, that actually weakens your case. There is other evidence in the record on which the ALJ might have relied. So I'm trying to ask myself, you know, if the ALJ relied on something as unreliable as this unsigned report with what seems to be wild speculation about who might have created it and when it might have been signed, I mean, it's just blank. That's very troubling. But what other evidence do you think is missing? I guess you were starting to talk about 2006 that there was no evidence.
Well, there are two residual functional capacity assessments in the file from examining doctors, and that was from Dr. Tobin and from Dr. Tracy, and both of those found that the appellant was limited to less than sedentary work. And so with Your Honor's statement that it weakens the case if the ALJ did not rely on the state agency's opinion, I would suggest that there is no other opinion in the file that stated Ms. Terry could perform sedentary work. In fact, the two opinions were less than sedentary, and then there was one state agency non-examining physician's opinion of light, which apparently the ALJ did not rely on because that's not what he found.
Right. I mean, and what I meant is if the only thing that supports the ALJ's opinion is this unsigned, undated report, it would seem to me a remand is probably necessary because, you know, anybody could generate a report with no signature on it from a computer at any time. If there is other evidence, and, of course, the commissioner does argue that there is, then that's a different matter.
Correct. Well, there are many errors with the ALJ's residual functional capacity finding. Under 96.8P, the ALJ is required to provide a narrative statement in his decision explaining how he came to that finding, and the ALJ did not do that in this case at all. And pursuant to this court's ruling in Briscoe versus Barnhart, that omission in and of itself is sufficient demand.
Well, you say that he didn't specifically consider the impact on your client's RFC of the pelvic fluid disorder, the urinary urgency, and the hematura. But ALJs don't have to consider every piece of evidence. Does the failure of the ALJ to not include these pieces of evidence really add to your argument? And is your client even still suffering from those problems?
It's the second question. I'm not sure if she is or not. With the first, the ALJ is not allowed to just ignore evidence. This court decided in Golombuski versus Barnhart, it was very similar circumstances where the plaintiff there also had urinary, but additionally bowel urgency problems. And the court stated that even if those impairments in and of themselves are not disabling, it did not justify the ALJ in ignoring the evidence entirely. And in this case, just by definition of urinary urgency, one would think that Ms. Terry would require needing to be near a restroom or need to use the restroom more frequently, and this could significantly impact her ability to perform work or to sustain work.
I had pretty much the same question as my sister over here, because we know that her treatment for the pelvic floor and urinary problems ended in 2005. So, of course, I was wondering whether she continued to suffer from those problems. But the other part of that that I wondered about was whether or not hers were controllable conditions, whether the record will tell us that.
I don't know that the record specifically states what limitations she would have had or how often she would have needed to use the restroom. There was just Dr. Goralnik's treatment note stating she had 0 out of 5 musculature in the pelvic floor and that she needed aggressive and intense treatment for that. And the record does not speak to after that report in 2005. Mm-hmm. However, the alleged onset date is November of 2004, and so at least for that time period it is relevant. The ALJ also made numerous mischaracterizations throughout the record, such that it's not possible to know, had the ALJ properly considered the evidence, what his decision would have been and or what additional limitations in the residual functional capacity finding there would have been, and how, again, that might have significantly limited or precluded the jobs. And as in the argument before me, at step 5, it is the commissioner's burden to prove that there are a significant number of jobs for Ms. Terry to perform. I'd like to go back to, if this court's interested, in the reasoning levels, is that was a fairly big issue in the case. Appellant pointed out a potential conflict between the ALJ's limitation of Ms. Terry to simple work and the reasoning level of 3, which was required by the DOT as a standard in all of the jobs that the ALJ found Ms. Terry could perform. Appellant is not asking that this court determine actually whether a conflict exists, but just recognize that a potential conflict is there and that the ALJ's failure to make the required inquiry of the vocational expert regarding whether his testimony was consistent or not, which he had to do before relying on the testimony, constitutes legal error under 004P and Prochaska, and then that requires remand. The reasoning levels, it's best to look at the range of them as they go from 1 through 6, 1 being the simplest and 6 being the most complex, and only the reasoning level of 1 limits the claimant to simple work. And so appellant argues that a reasoning level of 3 would thus be a conflict with the reasoning level of simple. Okay, thank you. I'll reserve the rest of my time.
Morning, Mr. Barron.
May it please the court. My name is James Guerin. I represent the commissioner in this case.
Well, you know where we're going to go with you, don't you?
Well, Your Honor, I...
you know where we're going. We're going to, with that report that, you know, we have no idea we prepared the report. We have, you know, we're referred to EWS notes, which are nowhere to find. It's unsigned, you know, incomplete report.
Yes, Your Honor,
kind of
I
worthless,
agree.
Kind of worthless, isn't it?
I think the report is, as we pointed out in our brief, I believe that we can reasonably infer the source of the report, but
well,
the fact remains.
I was not persuaded by that argument in your brief.
Yeah, we all have a problem
with
that.
Oh, you see what you've got. You've got a tsunami coming at you here.
I understand, Your Honor.
And EWS doesn't even correspond to anybody. You know, you have this final page, CEWS notes.
I believe that refers to electronic worksheet, Your Honor.
You know what? And what? How useless is that? It's like saying, see a computer on the 14th floor of the Dirksen building. We don't know which one. We don't know who wrote it.
And then this argument that whoever signed the reconsideration determination had to be the author of the unsigned opinion, there's no evidence presented to support that conclusion.
Well, Your Honor, I agree that there's no way we can definitively say who signed that report or when.
I would say there's no way other than total speculation, which is certainly not. I mean, the standards of evidence may be a little bit looser in Social Security hearings, but the evidence has to be shown to be reliable. And when you have no idea whether, you know, it was somebody's 3-year-old son who filled in these boxes or whether it was an actual physician, you can't use it.
And Judge Wood, I think that brings us to the next question. As you mentioned earlier, speaking with Ms. Kobayashi, that is, to what extent did the ALJ rely on this document?
I'm having trouble seeing what other evidence aside from this document would support the residual functional capacity assessment.
Well, if you look at page 36 of the appendix of plaintiff's brief, you can see that the ALJ says, in reaching this conclusion regarding the claimant's RFC, the undersigned has also considered the opinions of state agency medical consultants. One of those state agency medical consultants, the one that was signed and that isn't under question, found that Ms. Terry could perform a range of light work that exceeded the residual functional capacity that was found by the ALJ.
Now, who are you talking about here?
I'm referring to, give me just one moment,
the ALJ has an obligation to engage in both evidence in favor of and evidence against a particular finding at this stage.
Yes, Your Honor, and I believe that it's worth focusing on the fact that the other RFC form that I'm referring to is in the record at pages 93 to about 96, and this is Dr. Pat Chan, who found that Ms. Terry could lift and or carry up to 20 pounds occasionally and 10 pounds frequently, which would be consistent with a range of light work.
Now, where does the ALJ actually discuss this in the opinion?
Again, that's on page 36 of the...
But not by name. In other words, there's no actual engagement with this. You're guessing that that's what he must mean.
Well, the ALJ does mention that one of the state agency doctors found a range of light work. That's in that first full paragraph.
Did you say the doctor's name was Pat Chan? C-H-A-N?
Yes, Your Honor.
This is really coming from nowhere.
We discussed this in our brief at page 5.
Wait a minute.
But if I may, the question is what...
Your chance. Oh.
Sorry.
Sorry.
Let's see.
The problem is that when it's touched on not at all specifically in the ALJ's opinion, obviously arguments of counsel aren't a substitute for the ALJ's thinking. We don't see any way of resolving the conflict between this state agency physician, Pat Chan, and the other physicians who said that Ms. Terry was so limited.
Well, Your Honor, the ALJ actually explained why he rejected those opinions. The two opinions that Ms. Terry relies upon are the opinions of Dr. Tobin, her treating doctor, and the opinion of Dr. Tracy, the post-hearing consultative examiner. Now, the ALJ explained that he found Dr. Tobin's extreme limitations. In effect, finding that Ms. Terry was bedridden half of the day, he found those unsupported by Tobin's records. And in fact, Ms. Terry's attorney at the hearing admitted that those limitations were exaggerated. Even her attorney agreed that those weren't supported by the record.
Now, his statement wasn't quite as strong as the government portrays it to be. He does make a statement that it's a little stronger, but I don't think he's actually saying, Tobin is unreliable, this is exaggeration. The problem is finding out what the ALJ would have thought if this unsigned medical form weren't there. We don't know. I mean, ALJs balance lots of different evidence.
You know, another thing I would really like to ask you about, is it usual for ALJs to make wildly inappropriate jokes during hearings? I haven't, you know, seen that sort of thing. I think that body bag business, you know, was really inappropriate.
I think that probably could be one interpretation, Your Honor.
Well, what's the positive there? I mean, that was ridiculous, that statement that he made. And I suppose if she arrived at work in a body bag, that wouldn't be good either. And then the VE says no, and the ALJ says, yeah, we call these the dead claimant RFCs. And what's my job here to write checks? I mean, I'm worried about, that he relies on this report unsigned, and then it seems like he has a real attitude issue toward claimants of this type.
But I don't think, Your Honor, that he was actually referring to the claimant so much as the limitations that the doctor was setting forth.
Maybe he's belittling fibromyalgia, which he has no business doing, since it's a condition that rheumatologists will diagnose.
I believe, Your Honor, that the ALJ found that she had fibromyalgia, and that was part of the reason he limited her to a limited range of sedentary work.
So what do you think we should make of these comments? And getting back to Judge Rovner's questions, does this happen a lot? I haven't seen this.
Not in my experience, Your Honor.
Yeah.
You certainly don't think it's appropriate.
I don't think it's appropriate, but I don't think it was directed toward the claimant. I believe it was an offhand comment directed toward the attorney and toward the extreme and unsupported limitations that were set forth.
The claimant's sitting there in the room. How can it not be directed toward her?
Well, I believe he was speaking to the attorney.
I'm afraid that he might have been speaking in general as well, and that's pretty scary. Mm-hmm. What's my job here, write checks?
Mm-hmm.
Well, sometimes, maybe. Well, you're the messenger. I'm not, you didn't say these things. And
thank
sometimes
you
have to argue things you prefer not to. We understand that.
Well, I would like to point out very briefly, Your Honor, that the evidence supporting that Ms. Terry points to supporting her limitations, Dr. Tobin and Dr. Tracy, are both unsupported. As the ALJ pointed out, Dr. Tracy's limitations were based purely on his assumption that she would be undergoing surgery, which was not accepted. And we ask the court to affirm the commissioner's decision. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, Ms. Kobayashi.
Just briefly, with respect to Dr. Tracy's opinion, the ALJ did reject it because he stated that it was solely based on Dr. Tracy's opinion or Ms. Terry's statement that she was going to have surgery in the future. However, Dr. Tracy did perform his own objective evaluation of Ms. Terry. He found that she had a pronounced limp in her right leg, which could have accounted for his limitations in the assessment in standing and walking. He also assessed a very significant degree limitation in Ms. Terry's forward bend, and the ALJ mischaracterized that. The ALJ noted she had limitations bending side to side, but that she could forward bend. But Dr. Tracy only found that she could forward bend to her mid-thigh, And generally that's done by leaning forward and seeing how far your hands go down your leg. So to get to mid-thigh, that's hardly leaning forward. I think had the ALJ recognized that, he would have included an additional limitation in the RFC to bending. Further, Dr. Tracy relying on a possibility of surgery was consistent with the record, as Dr. Kerpad, Ms. Terry's treating spinal surgeon, stated during that time period that they were going to, if her pain did not decrease, they were going to consider re-exploratory surgery. And so to the extent the ALJ rejected Dr. Tracy's report because of the reliance on possible surgery was an error, as that was consistent with her treating spinal surgeon's opinion at that time. And appellant just asks that you reverse on those bases. Thank you.
You weren't court appointed, were you?
No.
Okay. Well, thanks to both counsel, and the case will be taken under advisement. Thank you.